Okay, well, so this week we're very happy to have Professor Stephen Simon from Oxford. Professor Simon got his PhD from Harvard and then did a postdoc at MIT before moving to Bell Labs. He was the director of theoretical physics research at Bell Labs from 2000 to 2008, and then since then has been a professor at Oxford. He is the author of a famous 2008 review on non-abelian anions and topological quantum computation, and more recently a popular introductory solid-state physics book, The Oxford Solid-State Basics. He's known as a very clear lecturer and teacher, and so it's great to have him here to tell us about the recent exciting developments on the anion front and in terms of observing them experimentally, but also the sort of backstory of the whole topic. So whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Thanks. It's actually a pleasure to be giving this talk. I still hope that I'm going to come to Perimeter someday soon and be able to talk to everyone in person, but that's going to have to wait till the post-COVID era. So the story I'm going to tell, the story of anions, is a very exciting story. I'm going to try to cover it from the theoretical inception of the idea in the 1970s all the way up to the experimental discovery of anions just this last year. It's a very big field. There's a lot of very beautiful works in the field. I'm not going to remotely cover everything. I'm going to leave a lot out. I'm going to just highlight a couple of works which helps us connect the beginning of the story to the recent progress. So I apologize for everything I'm leaving out. I also want to say that I really do encourage questions as we go along the way. There are parts at the end of the talk that can be jettisoned very easily if we don't have enough time. The stuff at the beginning is probably more interesting anyway. So please do stop me and interrupt so I can clarify things as we go. All right. So the story revolves around a question. It's an old question of what happens when you exchange two identical particles. So the story starts in 1924 with this rather famous letter from Bose to Einstein, starting, "Respected sir, I ventured to send you the accompanying article for your perusal and opinion." Well, by 1924, Einstein was already extremely famous. He probably got a lot of letters from all sorts of people. And if you didn't realize he was a genius already, he was a genius because he immediately recognized that this was no crackpot. This was a really serious letter from a very smart person. And he extended the work that Bose had done in this letter, and they published it, and we now have what we call Bose-Einstein statistics. The following year was Pauli exclusion principle, and the very same year, the discovery of Fermi-Dirac statistics, which was discovered neither by Pauli or Dirac. It was actually discovered by Jordan. And the reason it's named after Fermi and Dirac and not after Jordan is a bit of a historical accident. What happened was Jordan wrote a paper. He submitted it to a journal. The journal sent it to the referee. The referee we now know was Max Born. Max Born was a bit of a forgetful guy. He took the copy of the manuscript he had, and he stuffed it in his suitcase and only discovered it again about a year and a half later, after which time Fermi and Dirac had already published the same thing. Now, the physics community is usually pretty good about correcting errors of attribution. If someone had invented something first, we would usually attach their name to it. So we would call it Fermi-Dirac-Jordan statistics or something like that. And I think there's a reason why we don't do that. And the reason is because no one really liked Jordan. In the 1930s, Jordan became a huge Nazi, and it made a lot of enemies. Max Born later said that he absolutely despised Jordan's politics, although he felt tremendously guilty about robbing Jordan of the credit that he actually deserved. We never changed the name from Fermi-Dirac to Fermi-Dirac-Jordan statistics, which is called Fermi-Dirac statistics. There's a moral to this story, an important moral that we should all keep in our minds as we do our science. And the moral of this story is, don't be a Nazi. So seriously, don't be a Nazi. Anyway, so with that beginning, by 1930, a few years later, basically all of quantum mechanics was finished. It was entirely constructed in its modern form. And if you want quantum field theory completely finished, maybe by 1950, we have all the ideas of modern quantum field theory. During that time, you might say, well, didn't anyone ask if you could have any any statistics besides bosons and fermions. And you know, people did ask this question, could you have particles besides bosons and fermions? But they found whenever they tried to construct something that wasn't a boson and wasn't a fermion, they would get something that was a boson or fermion in disguise, sometimes known as parastatistics. In the 1970s, a number of important theorems were proven, often credited to Doppler, Hogg, and Roberts, that you really can't get anything besides bosons, fermions, maybe some gauge fields, and some internal degrees of freedom, and that's it. Now, that's how things stood until this sort of landmark paper by the two Jans in Norway, Jan Magne Linus and Jan Mørheim, in 1977, a paper called On the Theory of Identical Particles. And they came to the conclusion in this paper that in one and two dimensions, things are different. Now, we're not going to pay much attention to one dimension, but we're going to pay a lot of attention to two dimensions. And what they discovered was in two dimensions, a continuum of possible intermediate cases connects bosons and fermions. In particular, they proposed that you could have particles such that when you clockwise exchange the particles, you get a phase e to the I theta. And when you counterclockwise exchange them, you get a phase e to the minus I theta. Now, if you open up your quantum mechanics textbook, particularly those written before 1977, the dogma in those books, what they all say, is that you only have bosons and fermions. And the argument they use goes kind of like this. You define an operator which exchanges the position of two particles. You apply that operator twice, you put the particles back where they started. You exchange them once, and then you exchange them again, you get them back where you started. Now, there's only two square roots of the identity, plus one and minus one. So that means you can only have two types of you a minus sign, but then you exchange them again. The usual book, you know, the quantum mechanics books, tell us that that's all you get. And there's nothing else that you can possibly construct. Now that argument is actually, oops, there's a person raising their hand. Can you unmute yourself and ask whatever question you would like to ask?
Go for it.
Yeah. Hello?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I want to ask, in previous slide, in your previous slide, yes, this position independent variable in psi, is a position in Euclidean space or specifically Euclidean or in general, any position in Euclidean or non-Euclidean spaces? Position in space or only Euclidean?
I think this should be true in any, you know, you're saying if there's a metric or something, should be independent of that. There's no statement about if you're asking about whether it depends on having a metric, it the argument should work the same either way.
Okay.
Yeah. But the reason this argument isn't right, or in the modern era, we believe this argument isn't right, is because in 2+1 dimensions, two exchanges is not equal to the identity. So here I have a picture. I'm going to draw a lot of pictures with time running up vertically. So running up vertically, I'm going to exchange the particles once counterclockwise and then exchange them again counterclockwise. And what we see is that we've created a knot in the world lines of the particles. And it's easier to see this if you connect up the top of the knot to the bottom like this, and you can see that this picture here is not the same as this picture here, where the two world sets of world lines are unknotted. You'd have to cut one of these strings with a scissor and reconnect it in order to get the picture on the right. So this tells me that my argument that two exchanges the identity is just wrong. Now, why is it that we got away with that? Well, the reason all the quantum mechanics books get away with this is because in 3+1 dimensions, two exchanges is equal to the identity. This is a topological statement. And the statement boils down to saying that you can't make a knot in one-dimensional world lines if they're living in 3+1 dimensions. So if you have, you know, four-dimensional space, one-dimensional manifolds cannot not with each other. Now that statement is completely obvious to some people and is completely obtuse to some other people. So I'm going to try to make it obvious to everyone. I can't draw four dimensions, unfortunately, not even with the advantage of fancy PowerPoint. So I'm going to argue by lower dimensional analog. So in this picture here, I've drawn a one-dimensional line, and I'm going to think about particles moving on this one-dimensional line, so one plus one dimension. And I'm going to try to take these two particles towards each other and then get them past each other without crashing them into each other, without having them touch. Well, obviously, this is impossible. As you move them towards each other, they will inevitably crash. They can't get to the other side without crossing. Okay. However, if I say, okay, I'm not in one plus one dimensions anymore, I'm now living in two plus one dimensions, then it's really easy to get them past each other. We just jump out of that line, see it again, move out of the line and go around the other particle. Then you can go back on the line on the other side and you've gotten to the other side. Okay. Now we're going to go up a dimension here and we're going to imagine world lines in two plus one dimensions. So here I have two sets, we have two world lines, one particle here, world line, another particle here underneath. And there's no way that I can change the overcrossing to an undercrossing continuously without having those two world lines crash into each other in the same way as we had here, the two particles crashing into each other. If I try to bring those world lines towards each other, they always get stuck. However, if instead of moving in two plus one dimensions, I'm now allowed to move in three plus one dimensions, I can just displace one of these strands into the additional dimension, move it around, and then reconstitute it on the other side. Okay. So in three plus one dimensions, I can always unknot anything that looks like a knot in made of one dimensional strands. Okay. So what we conclude is that in three plus one dimensions, there are no knotted world lines of point particles. Therefore, two exchanges does equal the identity. So this realization is due to Lenas and Mörheim in 1977. And this paper, which we now view as being a brilliant landmark paper, was kind of ignored for a number of years. The first person to pay really much attention to it was Frank Wilczek 5 years later. And this paper by Frank Wilczek was only the fifth citation of the Linnaeus and Mörheim paper. And I believe three of those citations, the fifth paper to cite Linnaeus and Mörheim, I believe three of the other papers were by Linnaeus and Mörheim themselves. So no one really paid much attention to this until Wilczek came along. Wilczek was already quite well known at the time. And he also coined the term anion for these particles that are neither bosons nor fermions. So the word anion is a sort of linguistic joke. You have bosons, you have fermions, and anything else is an anion. Any type of statistic is anion if it's not boson or fermion. Anyway, in sort of an odd coincidence, the very same year, there was this experimental discovery of the fractional quantum Hall effect by Tsui, Stromer, and Gossard. And the following year, the elementary theory of quantum Hall effect was worked out by Bob Laughlin, resulting in a Nobel Prize, which was awarded in the late 90s. The following year after that, oops, another question. Go ahead.
I want to ask you about what is the meaning of quasi-particle?
Yes. So I will say something about that in a moment. I'm going to do a primer about a quantum Hall effect or quantum Hall effect in general. But in condensed matter, what we usually call a quasi-particle is a low energy excitation. If you have the natural low energy excitations are the quasi-particles. Okay. Good question. Thank you. So the following year after Bob Laughlin's theoretical work, it was shown that the quasi-particles in the low energy excitations in the fractional quantum Hall effect are anions. And this was shown first by Bert Halpern, and then a more detailed calculation by Aravas, Schrieffer, and Wilczek. Wilczek was famous already for his work on asymptotic freedom, which would win him a Nobel Prize much later. Bob Schrieffer, a Nobel laureate already for his work on superconductivity. And then Avrovas was the poor graduate student who had to do all the work. This discovery that fractional quantum Hall effects are anions was so convincing theoretically that pretty much the whole community accepted this as a fact. But it wasn't shown experimentally until just last year. And this is the story I'm going to tell, exactly how that that experiment was done, or that set of experiments was done, and also why they took so long. So first, just a couple of very basic statements about fractional quantum Hall effect. So fractional quantum Hall effect occurs in two-dimensional electron systems in strong magnetic fields when this ratio of electron density divided by the flux density is close to a small integer ratio, P over Q. Now, the one we're going to consider is this, the nu is 1/3. So you have 1/3 the number of electrons as you have magnetic flux. So these are states of matter which are gapped. There are no zero energy excitations, but the low energy excitations are interesting. They have a fractional charge to begin with. Their charge is 1/3 of the electron charge. That itself is very surprising. And you should sort of think of it as, you have this uniform soup of electron wave function, and the defects in that soup carry a charge of exactly 1/3 the charge of an electron. Now, the part we're going to be more interested in is the statistics of these particles, which is fractional. Just like Linnaeus and Mörheim said, you clockwise exchange of the two particles in the plane gives you e to the I theta, and counterclockwise exchange gives you e to the minus I theta. And for nu equals 1/3, the statistic is 2π/3 rather than zero or pi as you would get for bosons or fermions. There's just two more things that we're going to need to know about fractional quantum Hall effect. And one is the idea of a quantum Hall edge state. It was realized very, very early on in the history of quantum Hall effect, first by Bert Halpern, and much later by Wen and Fisher and Kane and lots of other people, that the edges of a quantum Hall sample have some interesting physics going on along them. So here I'm drawing an edge of a sample. So imagine the blue part being a fractional quantum Hall fluid. In other words, this is made of electrons down here. And out here, the white part, that's vacuum. We know that there's an electric field pointing, minus electric field pointing in. And the reason we know there's an electric field pointing in this direction is because if there were not an electric field pointing in this direction, the electrons would leak out. And they don't leak out into the vacuum. So that means there's an electric field holding them in. We also have a magnetic field perpendicular to the plane of the sample. And we know just from our elementary electromagnetism or mechanics that when you have a crossed electric and magnetic field, you have a drift velocity. And this drift velocity will carry current along the edge of the sample. And the current comes in little packets the size of these quasiparticles. So you have these little pieces of charge which run along the edge. And you can kind of, at least qualitatively, think of these as being quasiparticles drifting along the edge of the sample. And the experiments we're going to talk about are going to use this as a tool. There's one more piece of physics that we need, and it's the idea of a quantum point contact. So this is something you can do experimentally. Again, the blue region here is electrons, it's quantum Hall fluid, and the white region is vacuum. And the sample has been squeezed down by some electrodes in this region, so the edges come close to each other. Now, if you think about what's happening here along the edge, we have quasiparticles running along the edge, charges running along the edge like this. But if this is close enough, if the gap here is small enough, then every once in a while, the quasiparticle either jump across, or the wave function will split in some sort of beam splitter way at this quantum point contact. So whenever we have a quantum point contact, we should think of that as a half-silvered mirror, where some of the wave function can go one way and some of the wave function can go the other way. Okay. The experiments I'm going to talk about are two successful observations of anions that were done this last year using quite different techniques, actually. And if there's time at the end, I'll say something about non-abelians, which is a little bit of a related but slightly different story, which is in a much less advanced state, but still interesting. Let's start with this experiment, the anion collider experiment. And the history of this particular experiment goes back to a beautiful paper in the 1990s by Charlie Kane and Matthew Fisher. So back in the 1990s, people started getting interested in measuring the fractional charge on the quasiparticle and the fractional quantum Hall effect. So everyone believed that the quasiparticles and the fractional quantum Hall effect had fractional charge, but no one had ever measured it. And they proposed that a really nice way to measure the fractional charge would be by measuring the shot noise. That if you take any current, by measuring the noise on that current, you can often tell what the units of current are, how big the current is arriving in pieces, which is given by the charge of the elementary unit. And this is the actual experimental setup that they use. And here's basically a quantum Hall system, this rectangle here, and it's squeezed down to a narrow neck by this QPC, by this quantum point contact. And they're really just measuring current flowing through that narrow neck. And they just measure it very carefully and calculate the noise by measuring the current as a function of time. So this experiment was proposed. It was done just a few years later by two groups. The one group in France, and this was the predecessor of the experimental group that is going to be doing the experiment that we're talking about. And the other group was in Israel, Moti Heibloom's group at the Weizmann, and he's also a very important part of this puzzle, although he didn't do either of these two particular experiments. He did a lot of the intermediate experiments along the way. So anyway, this experiment was done by both groups, and both groups measured that I won't say exactly what this is, but the experimental curves of the amount of current noise versus current fit perfectly the E over 3 line, saying that the charge units are a third of an electron charge rather than what you would expect if it was an entire electron charge. So this was the first measurement of the unit of charge in these experiments. Another question. Yes, go ahead.
I want to ask about what is the concept of fractional charge in our classical description, not quantum, in classical description.
It's the same. There's nothing that prevents you from having a charge in classical description. There's nothing that prevents you from having a charge of any size. You can make a charge, classically you have a charge of any size whatsoever. It happens, the electron has a charge that we call E. The interesting thing is that we think of all of our charges in these systems as being made up of electrons and protons, both which have charge of E and minus E. But the charges in that's measured in the fractional quantum Hall system actually is a fraction of E, which is an emergent phenomenon, a rather interesting emergent phenomenon, but there's nothing particularly quantum about having a fractionalized charge. Okay. So this experiment was a rather important experiment, not only because it was the first measurement of this fractionalized charge, but also it was also cited very prominently in the Nobel Prize for the fractional quantum Hall effect as being evidence that the charge actually fractionalizes. But more important, this experiment started a technology that once people knew how to measure noise in these systems, which is actually kind of hard to do. I mean, this looks like a really simple circuit, but this all has to be, this whole circuitry has to be cryogenic. It has to be right on the same semiconductor chip to minimize noise. So there's a lot of trickery that goes on into building this kind of circuit and doing this kind of measurement. And once they knew how to do this, they could do lots and lots of other experiments along the same lines. And basically the history of the field then follows the history of quantum optics. So quantum optics, modern quantum optics, maybe starts with the Hanbury-Brown twist experiment. The Hanbury-Brown is one person and twist is another person. Hanbury-Brown has one of these people with a double-barreled but unhyphenated last name. It's rather complicated, but okay, it's two people. And what they proposed is you take a coherent light source, hit a half silver mirror, and then make measurements at two detectors. And what you're supposed to find is that when two photons arrive at the detectors at similar times, they're much, much more likely to be at the same detector than they are to be at opposite detectors. So the statement is the bosons bunch. They arrive in bunches at the same detector. Now, it was then proposed that you could do an electronic version of this, not using bosons, but using fermions, in particular, using electrons. This was proposed first by Marcus Butyrker, and the experiment was done several years later than the shot noise experiment by Klaus Ensslin's group. And here you can kind of see what's going on here. There's the quantum point contact, the half-silver mirror in the center here. Your current is sent in, and then you have two outputs, and you measure the correlation in the currents at the two outputs. And what they found was it was the opposite of the Hamm-Baire-Bowden twist. You find that the fermions anti-bunch, whereas the bosons bunch. Now, I should say that this experiment was not done with anions. It was done with electrons, but it's also a quantum Hall experiment. So it's done with integer quantum Hall effect. The integer quantum Hall effect is very similar to the fractional quantum Hall effect, except the charges don't fractionalize and you don't have fractional statistics. So you have just fermionic statistics and unfractionalized charges. Beautiful experiment, nonetheless. Hamm-Baire-Bowden twist proposed a second experiment just a few years later, which pointed out that in fact, the two incoming photons don't have to be from the same sources. You have two sources coming in and then four possible drains. And Moti Heibloom's group then did this experiment. Here we have four half-silver mirrors here, one, two, three, four, several different outputs with the current correlation being measured between the different outputs. And again, they came to the conclusion, actually the experimental proposal was again by Marcus Butyrker, and they came to the same experimental conclusion that bosons bunch, while bosons bunch, fermions anti-bunch, electrons anti-bunch. The Hong-U-Mandel experiment was done in the 1980s. This experiment is a little bit harder to actually do because it requires single photon sources, which weren't available until the 1980s. And the general idea is you send in single photons to a half silver mirror. And if the single photons are arranged so they hit this half silver mirror at the same time, then with high probability, they come out at the same detector. Whereas if they hit the half silver mirror at different times, then they will randomly go to the two different detectors. It's a rather beautiful experiment from the 1980s. And this was also done with electrons. This now by Gwendol Fev, the lead author of the experiment we're interested in a little less than 10 years ago. And the experimental setup here is again the quantum point contact in the mirror. That's the half in the middle here. That's the half silvered mirror. And then you need single electron sources, source one and source two. So the way you make a single electron source is you basically have a quantum dot, a very small region, on which there's a single electron eigenstate sitting. And so you put an electron in that eigenstate, then you raise the energy of that eigenstate until the energy for the electron is higher than if the electron instead chose to jump off onto the edge state. So you're basically pushing it, over off the hill, like pushing someone out of a chair. You tilt their chair until they fall out of the chair. So you're tilting the electron until he falls off of the eigenstate until he falls off the eigenstate onto the edge state and he runs along the edge. And when so you have two sources on either end, and when the two electrons arrive at the point contact at the same time, with high probability, they end up at opposite outputs. So whereas bosons bunch, the fermions anti-bunch, it's called a Pauli dip. It's basically the Pauli exclusion principle. Again, this was done with electrons, not with anions. So what about anions? Well, there's a rather long theoretical history of people discussing Hamm-Baire-Bowden twisting. And notice they hyphenated incorrectly up here. Hamm-Baire-Bowden twist experiments with anions or fractional quantum Hall edge states. The first one was Thierry Martin's group, lead author was Ina Safi. They came to the conclusion, rather important conclusion, that the fractional statistics has a very important effect on current correlations in noise measurements. The original experiments that they had proposed were not really realistic from an experimental standpoint. And the basically the theory had to go through many, many iterations of proposing slightly different and slightly different experiments until they came to one that was actually doable. And the experiment that was actually doable was eventually proposed in 2016 by Brent Rosenau, Ivan Lexkoziski, and Bert Halpern. And it looks complicated. This is the experimental setup. I'll show you the actual device in a moment. It has 3-point contacts. But the important one is the one in the center. This is the half silver mirror that where the action is going on. There's a bunch of sources and drains, but it's actually not that complicated. The quantum point contacts labeled 1 and 2 here, their only purpose is to prepare a low density gas of quasiparticles. So you put a large voltage on source 1, and so a lot of current runs to drain 1. From source 1 to drain 1 like this. Now, if you start squeezing on this quantum point contact, occasionally a quasiparticle jumps across this quantum point contact and runs along this edge. And the idea is you tune this first quantum point contact so you have a very rarefied gas of quasiparticles running along this edge going into quantum point contact 3. You do the same thing by charging up source 4 and getting a lot of current going between source 4 and drain 4, and then occasionally someone jumps across quantum point contact 2, so you have a rarefied gas coming into quantum point contact 3. So the interesting thing is you have current coming in from both sides into quantum point contact 2, and it comes out at drain 3 and drain 2, and you can look for bunching or anti-bunching behavior. When you straighten out this diagram, you sort of unfold it, you have quantum point contact 1, which prepares this rarefied gas, quantum point contact 2, which prepares this rarefied gas, and then there's a tunneling at the half silver mirror and 2 drains, and you measure the current correlation between these 2 drains. If you set things up appropriately normalized and such that the currents coming into this quantum point contact 3 are the same from either side, an actual calculation done by these 3 people comes up with the following expression for the current-current correlation. Then there's 2 parameters that go into this formula. One is the statistical angle, which we believe to be 1/3, plug that in, and the other is an edge screening parameter. Now, that's something that we don't actually know. The problem is that the quasiparticles have Coulomb charge, and this Coulomb charge allows them to interact directly with each other. I mean, they have some sort of statistical interaction that they get a phase when they go around each other. But in addition, they have a direct Coulomb interaction because these are charged objects. If you took away the Coulomb interaction completely, this parameter lambda would be 1/3. And to a large extent, that's what it looks like. The Coulomb interaction is not important in the end. So if you plug these in, you get a number, which is -2 for the current-current correlation. So here's the actual experiment by Gwendol Feb's group. The actual setup of the experiment here. Here's in the middle is the actual half silver mirror that we're interested in. The quantum point contact here is preparing a rarefied gas. The quantum point contact here is preparing a rarefied gas. Both of these gases are coming in towards the central half silver mirror, and then we're measuring current coming out at 3 and 4 here and here. They can measure the output current as a function of how imbalanced the currents are coming in from the 2 different directions. If they're not imbalanced at all, you get exactly this number -2, which is predicted. And then there's some more complicated formula if the currents are imbalanced. And that actually also matches the data as well. So it's a pretty good agreement with the theory. With the theory at the end of the day. So maybe I should stop there and ask if there are any further questions on that experiment before I go on to discuss the second experiment. Okay, I'll move on to the second experiment. Actually, I should maybe mention that it's a little surprising that the edge screening parameter is that you put in is the screening parameter that you would expect for uncharged anions. However, what the theorists argue is that if you modify this parameter lambda, it must be modified in a direction which makes this minus two get closer to zero. It can only go in one direction. And zero would be what you would expect for regular fermions. Minus two is what you expect for these anions. And the fact that you measure minus two then leaves no other option, but these things are actually anions. If there was anything, maybe it's slightly above minus two because of some, but it's pretty close to minus two. So it looks like the interactions for some reason aren't that important. Okay. So the second experiment came out just a few months later. It's a completely different technique. And their title is, so the lead author here is Michael Manfra, the postdoc who did the work is Jamie Nakamura. And this is from the group in Purdue. And so they titled this experiment Direct Observation of Anionic Brain Statistics. And presumably that phrase is used to sort of disambiguate their experiment from the fractional statistics and anion collisions, which they would call an indirect observation. So the history of this experiment goes back, I think, to a paper by Steve Kivelson in 1990, who pointed out that if you think about a charged region in a quantum Hall sample, there could be anions running around that charged region, and the eigenstates of that dot would tell you something about the statistics of the particles that are running around it, so that you could in principle see something about the fractional statistics by measuring in detail the structure of a dot. This was fleshed out into an actual proposal for experiment by Claudia Chamoun, Denise Fried, Steve Kivelson, Shivaji Santhi, and Xiaogan Wen, 1997. And the principle of this experiment is basically that of a Fabry-Perot interferometer. So again, we have fractional quantum Hall fluid, this blue region here, and quasi-particles run along the edge, but occasionally a quasi-particle will partially jump across. So here it's acting like a beam splitter. So it splits into two partial waves. One partial wave goes around the interference cavity and then comes back and re-interferes, and it goes on its way. So this is exactly like we have in an optical Fabry-Perot interferometer. There's a beam splitter and a mirror here, and we want to see the interference going back and forth in this cavity. So what we have at our disposal is, we're going to measure the resistance of this device, which is going to reflect the interference, the phase angle between the part of the wave that is directly scattered across and the part of the wave that goes all the way around the cavity. And there'll be two contributions to that phase. One will be from the fact that you have a charged particle going around a flux, E star going around phi, that's just regular Harnoff-Bohm effect. And then one part comes from basically the distance traveled by the particle, and that can be changed with a voltage. So you put a side gate voltage, which you can change the voltage on the system, you change the length that this particle has to travel, and that will then change the interference from constructive to destructive, and you'll see this sort of sine wave in the resistance of the sample. Now, the whole shooting match is what happens when you add a quasi-particle to the center of that interference cavity. Well, since it's a fractionally charged particle, the particle going around the cavity, do I have this here? Oops. Yeah, this particle going around the cavity encircles this particle in the center of the cavity, and then it will pick up this theta anion angle, which in this case should be 2π/3. So you get the black interference curve without the quasi-particle in the middle of the cavity. But then when you add the quasi-particle in the middle of the cavity, you get the blue interference curve shifted by 2π/3. Okay, and that's what we're going to try to see. Now, this experiment was tried a number of times over the course of history, starting probably with Vladimir Goldsman's group. He certainly saw oscillations, but there was a lot of confusion that the oscillations didn't seem to behave the way they were supposed to behave. Question, go ahead.
I have a question. Can you explain again how you add a quasi-particle in the bark there?
Yeah, yeah. So, from an experimental standpoint, how do you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you could, and let me back up. So in the original proposal here, what they did was they actually imagined having a electrical gate in the middle of the device, which would attract, which you could add charge to, and it could attract units of charge into the center. That was the original proposal. In practice, that's not going to be what happens, but that's the idea that at least in principle, you could do that.
And is it clear that when you open the gate, you attract only one particle, or you get a
current? You could attract two, you could attract three, yeah. But presumably, if you tune the gate continuously, they'll come in the minimal units. At least that's the idea. They'll come in the minimal discrete units. Okay, going back forward, but we'll see exactly how this happens in a moment in the actual experiment. So in this particular experiment by Goldman, they saw oscillations. But they didn't seem to be, the oscillations didn't seem to behave the way you would want oscillations to behave. And so there's a lot of confusion. And this confusion was sorted out by Rosenau and Halpern, and then a longer paper by Halpern, Stern, Nader, and Rosenau in late 2007, and then 2011. And what you actually do here is we actually plot the resistance as a function of two parameters. This parameter here, the flux, that's the magnetic field, and the other is the side gate voltage that you can vary. So you can vary two things in this experiment. And when you plot the resistance as in the color plot, you get these patterns, which are called pajama patterns, because presumably someone's pajamas looks like this. And the pajama stripes either go down to the right or they go up to the right. And the original proposal was to see the down to the right over here. And this is what we now call a Harnoff-Bohm regime, where basically there's no electrical charging effects of the interference cavity. So basically the problem is that the theory had been worked out and the absence of Coulomb charging effects, but there's actually a lot of Coulomb charge in small cavities. So the edge states have Coulomb charge, the quasi-particles have Coulomb charge. And so the actual phase that you measure has a Coulomb contribution. Over here at this end of things, what we call the Harnoff-Bohm regime, the Coulomb correction is negligible. And you see things going down to the right, and you see this expression, this piece here plus number of anions times the anion phase here, and no Coulomb correction. However, over here you're in the so-called Coulomb dominated regime, and the Coulomb dominated regime basically you're measuring almost entirely the Coulomb correction, and you're not seeing any of the statistical angle at all. So this proposal was checked by experiments. This is a nice experiment by Charlie Marcus's group. And what they did is they varied the size of the interference cavity. If you make the interference cavity extremely large, then the Coulomb charging energy is small. You're allowing charge to spread out over a much bigger distance, and the charging energy gets very small. And so you're in this Harnoff-Bohm regime where Coulomb charging energy is not important. Whereas if you make the interference cavity very small, you get a large charging energy and you get into the Coulomb-dominated regime with stripes going up and to the right. And this was reconfirmed by a number of other experimental groups. And you would say, okay, so now you know what to do. You just make a big, you just need to make a big enough interference cavity, and then you can measure your fractional statistics. Sounds great, but no one ever found a Harnoff-Bohm pajama patterns in the fractional quantum Hall regime. So, you know, all these experiments were done in the integer quantum Hall regime. This picture here was done in the integer quantum Hall regime. So, not fractional quantum Hall effect. When they went to fractional quantum Hall effect, they would never get a Harnoff-Bohm regime. They would always see things going up and to the right, never down and to the right. And that was particularly disturbing. To add to that confusion, the Moti Heiblum's group, again at Weizmann, built a different type of interferometer, so-called Mach-Zehnder interferometer, which also never saw interference of fractional quantum Hall effect at all. And it was proposed by a number of people that, in fact, fractional quantum Hall quasiparticles just wouldn't interfere, that you could never get interference of fractional quantum Hall effect quasiparticles at all. There was some rays of hope from various other groups trying to do this experiment, one from the Bell Labs group, Bob Willett, another from Wuhan Kang's group at University of Chicago. But these experiments both had some problems with them. This one, didn't look very periodic, wasn't really measuring statistics right, was unclear exactly what was being seen. This experiment, it looked beautiful, like it was seeing exactly the right thing, but the data didn't seem to ever reproduce. We had some theory about why it is that this might be doing the right thing, but it was a little distressing that they couldn't consistently come up with the right, what seemed to be predicted by theory. The big breakthrough was made by Mike Manfra, who's not only an experimentalist in terms of measuring semiconductor devices, but he also grows the semiconductor devices, which is a real art form in itself. This is the structure, or this is a simplified version of the semiconductor structure that they used. It's quite complicated, and 20 years of or 30 years of development went into figuring out how to grow exactly this type of semiconductor stack. And the brilliance of this particular device is the following: the electron gas that we're measuring is in the middle, but then added nearby are, without actually electrical connection to the quantum well, very close by are two additional planes of electrons. And these additional planes of electrons, their purpose here is just to screen the Coulomb interaction, prevent the Coulomb interaction from having a large energy. So, from your elementary E&M, if you put a metal gate near a charge, it turns out instead of having long-range Coulomb interaction, you get dipolar interaction between charges. And here I'm going to screen it from both sides, so it's no longer dipole; it's octopolar or something. And so the interaction between charges is extremely reduced. So this was Manfra's idea, and it worked beautifully. And what they wanted to see was when they add the quasiparticle, the interference pattern shifts. Okay, here's the actual data. And so you see the pajama patterns going down and to the right. So you're in the Harrnoff-Bohm regime as you want it to be. And then as they change the parameters in the experiment, you occasionally see a slip of the interference pattern, this like along these dotted lines. Now, these lines, it's a little bit hard to draw these. The darker lines here are guides to the eye. It's a little bit hard to place them exactly. So it's a little bit hard to put an exact number on exactly the angle of the phase slip, but to a very good approximation, we can make, these things are giving you 1/3 of 2π phase slip along these lines. Yes, question.
Can I just make sure I understand the previous slide? The picture.
This one.
No, this one. In this picture, is this a cross section of the? In other words, is the magnetic field here pointing out of the slide, or is it pointing vertically up the slide?
It's pointing vertically up the slide.
Okay,
so the plane of the sample is this line across here, and then out of the board at you.
Okay.
So this is perpendicular. So going up on the slide is perpendicular to the, is normal to the two-dimensional electron gas.
Okay, thank you.
So we have a second gas, electron gas, which is parallel to the first electron gas, and another electron gas, which is parallel to the first electron gas. And then these electron gases have to be electrically decoupled from each other, and you have to find a way to be able to measure just the one in the middle. So let's see. So it's a pretty complicated experiment, actually. Okay. So this is the actual data. And it's pretty convincing that what they're seeing is occasional phase slips as single quasiparticles enter into the interference cavity. Now, if this wasn't convincing enough, and I would say most people were pretty convinced by this data, but of course there's always some holdouts. What they did next is in an archive posting that you published, they actually started pinning down a lot of the parameters of this experiment in real detail. So they know the electrostatic charging energy of the dot. They know the electrostatic interaction between the edge states and the quasiparticles. They know they're able to measure a whole bunch of parameters of the particular device and, you know, cross-check them against each other. And you know, as they sort of measure more parameters and cross-check, you know, the results, everything seems to fit together that they're seeing what they think they're seeing. So, you know, as they make more measurements, the data looks more and more convincing that they really are measuring the right thing. And it's a very, very direct measurement of the statistical angle. So what next? Well, first of all of these experiments measure nu equals 1/3. And there's lots and lots of, you know, there's a zoo of other fractional quantum Hall states, 2/3, 2/5, 3/5, 3/7, 4/7. There's, you know, almost 100 different, and probably even more than 100 different fractional quantum Hall states have now been measured. And you might say, well, you know, what's new to learn? Well, it's actually, you know, if you had measured three or four of them and they all were doing the right thing, it may not be so interesting to measure the fifth or the sixth. But in fact, nu equals 1/3 is the only one that they've managed to get to give any sort of data that looks remotely sensible. Even if they look at 2/3, the data looks very confusing. So there's something going on about more complicated edge states. I mean, the edge state of 2/3, I mean, the reason we focus on 1/3 is because it actually has a very simple edge state structure. 2/3 has a more complicated edge state structure. And correspondingly, we don't understand exactly what it's doing. 2/5 has a more complicated edge state structure, and we don't understand what it's doing. So trying to sort out the basics of how more complicated edge states work is something that's on the agenda. And then, of course, there is the rare, elusive non-abelian fractional quantum Hall effect. I'm not going to, I mean, I could talk about that for 15 minutes, but I think instead I just want to say just a couple words about what non-abelian fractional quantum Hall effect is, why it's interesting. And I can sort of end in saying that it hasn't been measured yet, at least not convincingly. So non-abelian anions obey non-abelian statistics. And so that raises a question what non-abelian statistics are. So non-abelian statistics, we imagine having our two-dimensional system here, and then we have a bunch of quasi-particles, say four of them at fixed positions, R1, R2, R3, R4 in our system here. And then we have to assume that even once we fix the position of the particles, say there's two degenerate orthogonal possible wave functions that we can have the system live in. So the initial wave function that we're talking about is generally going to be some linear superposition between psi A and psi B. And we can, you know, for the sake of simplicity, we can write that as a vector or a spinner here. Now we're going to then take the particles, braid them around each other in some complicated way like this. And then we bring the particles back to exactly the same positions. And so again, the wave function must be made up of some combination of psi A and psi B. We'll call them psi final, a linear superposition made up of A final, B final. And the A final, B final must be some unitary transform on some 2x2 matrix here on A initial, B initial. What's interesting here is not that it's a unitary matrix, all quantum mechanics is unitary. What's interesting is the particular unitary matrix that you apply to get from the initial to the final depends only on the topology of the braid. So if you do a particular braid, you only care about the topology, the knot that you formed, and that will tell you what unitary matrix connects the final to the initial. The reason people are interested in this is because this makes a great qubit. And you can do operations on your qubit by doing braiding. It's also very well protected from noise and error because no local operators can mix the multiple ground states. Almost all noise processes are local. There's a history of non-abelian anions that really goes back to Sandra Bias working in the context of gauge theories, then the topological quantum field theory, conformal field theory people like Moore and Seiberg and Witten, Froelich, Freidenhagen company. Then it started leaking into condensed matter, people like Halpern, and then Moore and Reed. wrote a rather landmark paper on how non-abelians can give arise, can arise in fractional quantum Hall effect. There were then a couple of really important developments. First, a paper by Rudolf Morf, claiming that the Nuegel's 5 half state, which had been discovered in fractional quantum Hall effect in the 1980s, is a non-abelian quantum Hall state. And then two beautiful papers by Alexei Kateyev, suggesting that this type of physics, whether it's anions or just unpaired Majoranas, could be used for quantum computation. On the strength of these ideas, Microstoff Station Q was formed in Santa Barbara. And by this time, they've spent easily $100 million on the idea of building a quantum computer out of non-abelian anions. At first, they were interested in fractional quantum Hall effect, but now they've sort of turned most of their attention towards Majoranas. But they're generally pursuing several different directions thought to maybe allow for non-abelian physics, and then maybe quantum computation with these types of particles. Probably the unfortunately the most publicized result in this field was a huge retraction earlier this year. There was a high profile letter in Nature where they claimed that they had measured Majoranas, which are non-abelian particles in some sense, in an experiment in 2018. And then that paper was retracted in 2021. And we can have a long discussion as to whether there was foul play in this paper or if it was just plain stupidity. And then, you know, in the quantum Hall world, people are trying to do similar interferometry experiments, but at Nuegel's 5 halves. I think I don't have enough time to talk about what the intended signature is, of which would be slightly different at Nuegel's 5 halves, that would show that you do have non-abelian physics. But I think it suffices to say, oops, screen sharing has stopped and the window is closed. Well, I didn't mean to do that, but okay. I think it's a good time to call it quits then, because in fact, my conclusion slide was basically that whereas we now have finally very good experimental evidence of anions in at nu equals 1/3, the non-abelian anions is still well, certainly not proven, and maybe some ways away before it's shown. So I'll stop there. Take any more questions that people have. There's something in the chat, I think. So let me take a look at that. Oh, yes. Lee Smolin. Yes, I am aware. Thank you, Lee. Yeah. I'm habitually the comment in the chat is, I know exactly which slide that you are referring to too. One of the first slide, I said something was knotted, whereas in fact, a mathematician, we call it linked. I'm very sloppy about calling something a knot versus a link, but yes, I know that if it's made up of more than one strand, we call it a link rather than a knot. I agree. Yeah. But in the common parlance, we would call it knotted.
All right. Well, let's thank Stephen for a great talk. Very interesting. And so let me ask, are there any questions from students to start with? Or if students are still brewing their questions, maybe from non, let me open it to non-students.
I don't bite.
Maybe while it was too clear is the problem with this talk. Let me start with a question. So you mentioned that Microsoft started with by trying to find the non-abelian anions in the 5-halves state of fractional quantum Hall, and then switched to Majoranas.
Yeah.
Is it simple to explain why they changed tack?
Well, they were getting frustrated. Was what happened. The experiments seemed like they were going to be very simple. And even after putting a lot of effort into a number of experimental labs, everything just looked like it was a mess. They couldn't figure out what was going on in any of the experiments. And then there were some theoretical papers which looked, you know, very convincing that you should be able to build Majoranas out of various superconductor, semiconductor devices, like these Majorana quantum wires. And the theory looked very simple, and it looked like it was going to work beautifully. And so they redirected a lot. And I think one of the advantages of the Majorana approaches is that there seemed to be a lot more variety of things you could try. And, you know, you could try quantum wires, you could try surfaces of topological insulators, you could try surfaces of topological superconductors, you could try, you know, Josephson junctions, topological Josephson junctions. There seem to be a lot of different options of ways that you could get Majoranas in condensed matter experiments using some of these tricks, basically going back to the ideas of Alexei Kateyev from 2000. And there were very, very few experimentalists in the world were working on fractional quantum Hall effect. And these experiments were really finicky. They only, you know, fractional quantum Hall effect, most of these experiments are done at you know, around 10 millikelvin or something like that. And even though the superconducting experiments are cryogenic experiments, most of them you could get away with 300 millikelvin or even 1 kelvin, and the experiment's probably going to work just fine. So that made the number of people who was willing to try them much higher. It just looked like there was more ways that you could turn this into an actual technology. You could use lots, a bigger variety of materials. You know, more people knew how to create these materials. It just looked a lot more promising for a lot of reasons. Now, you know, after they've devoted, you know, more than a decade into trying to see a single Majorana in quantum wires and other devices, maybe they're reconsidering whether this was a good idea after all, because, you know, yeah, I mean, condensed matter experiment is hard, and there's a lot of red herrings, a lot of things get in your way that you didn't expect. And there's a lot of things that you thought you understood that it turns out you don't understand. You know, I think it was the grass was looking greener on the other side of the fence. And so they went whole hog into the Majorana business. I have to say that the theory behind the Majorana experiments is very convincing that it really should work. And I think, you know, it took a lot of head scratching to try to figure out, you know, what could be going wrong with these Majorana experiments, and they still don't really know. There's a question here from Hilary C. Please, can you say a little bit more about the experimental evidence for nu equals 2/3 anions? So, so 2/3 should look. There's no experimental evidence for 2/3 anions. There has been, you know, experiments at 2/3 that show fractional charge. But there's been no convincing interference experiments done at 2/3. There's been no, none of these anion collider experiments done at 2/3. The problem with 2/3 is it has multiple edge states. Depending on the particular nu equals 2/3 you're considering, there's more than one possible nu equals 2/3 fractional quantum Hall effect. The two edge states can be either co-propagating or counter-propagating. And that either way, that can make things complicated, and it can obfuscate a lot of the results. So as of yet, there is no experimental evidence for anions at 2/3, although people don't doubt it at all. I mean, the theory behind you know, these fractional quantum Hall states is rock solid, and numerics are rock solid. But you know, you want to see it in an experiment, and not only just because it's not proven until you actually see it, but also because that will tell you a lot about the physics of the samples that you really need to learn so that you can actually do the experiments. So it convinces you that you really understand the details of what's going on. Good question.
Okay, last question, Karim.
I want to ask about if onions form a special state of matter or not under certain conditions, as a hypothetical state of a special state of matter or experimental.
I'm not sure. So I'm not exactly sure I understand the question, but let me rephrase it, which I think might address what you're asking about. So you ask, let me phrase the question this way: are anions fundamental particles, or are they emergent particles? Well, you know, I might argue that every particle we've ever measured anywhere in the world is all we know is that at the energy scales where we're measuring it, it's a particle. And it's the same in fractional quantum Hall effect. At the energy scales we're thinking about, these are the particles. If you go to much higher energies, you realize, okay, this is really a defect in an electron soup. But the effective degrees of freedom at the energy scale of the experiment are electrons, are these fractional charged quasiparticles, not electrons. You can say the same thing about, we like to think of our electrons as being fundamental particles because no one has found a way to fractionalize, electrons in high energy physics, but it's really just a statement about the energy scales that we're considering. Maybe at some other energy scales, they don't look like they're a fundamental particle. Okay, there's one question from Ray Laflamme. The effective world we live in is 2+1. I understand we can make structures that look like 2+1, but the experiments see a de facto of the third dimension is there, or 2+1 such a great approximation. So that's exactly the same answer that I just gave, that there's a, you're seeing the effective theory at that energy scale. So you've trapped particles in a two-dimensional well, and you've arranged such that excitations, going up to the second eigenstate perpendicular to the direction of the well is too energetically costly, and it never happens. So you have a strictly two-dimensional system. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. And the approximation is really, really good in the experiments you do.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The experiment. Yeah. Really. I mean, the next excitation, the excitation to the next level of the quantum well is like, 150 Kelvin, and the experiments are done at 10 millikelvin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Preferably.
Okay. Is there one more question from Lee? I see.
Yes, I'm wondering, supposing we had a fundamental physics where there were one-dimensional charged excitations, could we braid them and have an inverse effect and make electrons and quarks?
I'm not sure, but I can say that certainly if you can get exotic statistic, if you allow your fundamental particles to not be points, but rather to be lines, then in 3+1 dimensions, you can have complicated fractional statistics. I mean, you know, this, you can get, two gauge theories and all sorts of exotic things like that, going on. Now, whether you could arrange for emergent electrons and quarks from that, I don't know. That's above my pay grade, at least for now. One more question.
It's just a question about the experimental setup. So you talked about the old sample and creating this tunneling. Is the technology able to? Can you think about interacting two different? Old plane, like creating a corner, and
yeah.
Is that tried, and what do you
think? Yeah, it has been. So you can do corners. You can bring edges close to each other to have line junctions along the edges. I mean, lots and lots of these things have been tried in the history of quantum Hall effect. Often the problem is that they work. But often there's a lot of disorder. So you have to wrestle with that at these junctions. There's some really clever tricks to minimize the disorder. So it doesn't completely dominate everything, but disorder is always there. And you do have to worry about how that's going to affect your experiment. When you're squeezing something down to just a point, disorder is not really that much of a problem, because, you know, if there's a little bit of disorder, okay, maybe your point forms, you know, half a micron over from where you intended it, but you don't care. But if you have a line junction and, you know, and there's bumps along that line, it may make a big difference. So you have to wrestle with that. But there've been some beautiful experiments, with people like Matthew Grayson and you know, they developed a technique for, growing, two-dimensional electron gases on perpendicular edges and all sorts of fancy things like that. So there's a lot that can be done, but it's, so far, I mean, they weren't able to use it to measure fractional statistics.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot again, Stephen, for that great talk. And let's call it there in view of time.
Okay. Bye-bye.